without making insurance more affordable, without expanding benefits. And it's just an enormous cost-shifting effort. The worst part about it is that it was sold as an improvement, and everybody wants to give the Affordable Care Act a few decades to fail before we try something new. When, in fact, we don't need to wait for it to fail. We're already failing. And we need to do something completely different. We need to learn from the healthcare systems that already provide better care to more people for less money, which is to say every other industrialized country, and learn from them. And the one thing they have to teach us that they all have in common is you have to cover everyone. The United States still hasn't learned that lesson. We still can't believe that if we expand care to everyone and give everyone comprehensive benefits, that we in fact save money because we're not spending $350 billion a year telling people no.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Sam Metz, anesthesiologist and member of Mad as Hell Doctors. Really, really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and sharing your perspective.
Thank you. It was a great chance to talk.
I'm Kanan Schlesinger with KBOO News.
This is KBOO Portland. Listener.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Inner City Blues Festival's Healing the Healthcare Blues on Saturday, April 16th from 6 p.m. to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge in Portland. The campaign for universal healthcare for every citizen is growing around the United States. Our local organization, Healthcare for All Oregon, has brought the movement to the stage for an outreach and fundraising mega concert featuring Vicki Stevens and the True Blue Lady Cat, Rosalind Hunters with LaRonda Steele, Terry Robb, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. KBOO will be broadcasting live from the event. Again, that's Healing the Healthcare Blues on Saturday, April 16th from 6 p.m. to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as Bidder 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
Yeah. Hello, KBOO Land. Welcome to Trans Positive PDX. Yay. We're so excited to be here tonight. Trans Positive PDX is a new program exploring the vibrant activism going on in the Portland transgender, two-spirit, non-binary, gender nonconforming, intersex, etc. community through the strength of our vibrant and diverse trans and gender queer communities. We hope to connect listeners with the ongoing activist arts, culture, and dialogue happening in Portland and beyond. Transpositive PDX is especially concerned about underrepresented voices of trans people of color, homeless youth, and the most vulnerable of our community. So I'd like to start off, first of all, just by welcoming you to our audio collective. We have six people in studio tonight. We have Natasha Delapine, Kyle Ward, Maria Ward, Rowan Everard, and Nicolette James. Welcome, everyone.
Yay.
Hi.
And so we're all going to go around first. This is our very first show, and we're going to be doing this show as a collective. So nobody owns the show. The show belongs to the trans community. So we're going to start off that way by having everyone have a chance to introduce themselves and talk about why they're here and what they hope to get out of the show. And we're going to start with Natasha Delapine.
Hi there. I'm Natasha, and I've lived with the intersex condition all my life. Based on these experiences, I hope to be able to bring to the table scientific information that's been parsed down to bite-sized small bits that we can use in the trans and also intersex community. Basically, I've found out we have a lot of the same things in common, whether or not you have physically changed or if you just have a natural change happening, such as puberty and also an artificial puberty. We all kind of have a transitional life ahead of us. So this is kind of connecting to everyone at this point, but we can also focus on the specific types of transitioning and specific kinds of change. So the scientific, the cultural, everything combined, but so much that we have to do is self-care. And I think that could be part of the reason we could decide about amongst ourselves what the best tools we have in our community that we have available. So prescriptions is one of them for hormones, and that's where I'm kind of getting my foot in the door as far as news right now.
Great, thank you. And we also have Kyle Ward.
Yes, hello. So the reason why... Sorry, guys. Okay. So the reason why I joined this collective was I came out last year and have progressively been coming out since. And I'm excited to start my journey pretty soon. You know, there's a chance looking at doing taking hormones soon and starting that. So on top of that, I am part of the Basic Rights Oregon Transgender Justice Volunteer Task Force. And so I'd like to bring in some information from that and let you guys know what's going on in the community and what Basic Rights Oregon's doing so much for us. And on top of that, I think I'd really like to see how we can create allies all over the state and let those who have come out and haven't found a community can find it in places outside of Portland, rural community, Salem, wherever we're listening on the air or online, and just be able to develop that for everybody. Yeah.
Hey for Basic Rights Oregon. And we have Maria Ward.
Hi. So the reason I'm here is I'm kind of bringing the perspective of a partner. I am Kyle's wife, and sort of through this journey together, I've realized that I am, you know, non-gender conforming as well, kind of fall in that androgynous spectrum. And so I want to be able to bring partners into the journey with their trans partners and sort of help them to help themselves and help support their partners as well. And I'm also just looking to provide sort of a home where partners and those who are maybe not fully transitional, but kind of in that in-between area to kind of learn about what that means and that it's okay to, you know, not really fall on either side.
And we have Rowan Everard.
Hi. So I am an acupuncturist here in town. I work at Seven Star Acupuncture here in Southeast, and also at the Ecchi Institute, which is going to be, which is already open, but is going to be more fully opening at the end of the month when our construction is done. And we are going to be an integrative primary care home for queer and trans people in Portland, where a place where people I can actually just easily know, like, I can go here for my healthcare and I won't have to worry about it because people won't be creepy and they'll know what they're doing with my healthcare. Amazing. And we'll also be able to do some sort of creating best practices and training people and doing some rotations and things through there. So we're hoping to increase the availability of healthcare, not only through our institution, but also by training people and all those good things. So that's some of what I do. I also, I've been working with Basic Rights Oregon for the last, gosh, like 5 years as an activist on the Trans Justice Working Group, mostly around healthcare and healthcare access, you know, getting OHP to cover trans stuff, getting trans stuff covered in other plans, training providers, threatening to sue people sometimes. we haven't done it yet, but sometimes you gotta, you know, give people a little hairy eyeball. So I'm kind of a semi-professional nerd, and I'm really into policy wonkery, and particularly thinking about movement history and the way that movements can be effective, and sort of, yeah, deep diving into the nitty-gritty of what different policies actually look like with regard to people who are queer or trans or intersex. So that's my deal.
Hooray. And finally, we have Nicolette James here today.
Hi. So I'm a non-binary transgender person, which for anyone who doesn't know what that means, non-binary is an umbrella term for any gender that isn't specifically male or female. And it took me a really long time, many, many years of just deep digging research about gender to figure out who I was, because right now there's not a whole lot of information about gender in general, especially in the non-binary spectrum, because, you know, the vast majority of society these days is being taught from a very early age that, you know, gender is biological sex and gender is just male and female. And that's why so many people are having such a hard time accepting that transgender people exist and accepting that intersex people exist. And especially now, as I'm coming out as non-binary, I'm finding a lot of people, even if they do believe in being transgender, they tell me that my gender doesn't exist. So I'm hoping to help raise awareness about, you know, what gender is, how it actually works, and of course the issues that we're facing in the trans community. And I'm hoping that by raising awareness and bringing in my perspective, especially with all the research that I've done, that all of us together can help help the trans community in our progression to gain the rights and treatment that we deserve.
Great, thank you. And my name is Emma Lugo. I guess I identify as a trans woman. I'm 5 or 6 years post-transition, and I'm a volunteer down here at KBOO. I'm a producer for the show Prison Pipeline, which airs on Mondays at 6:30. And that's kind of my entry point into KBOO. And when I heard that KBOO had the queer programming block open, which used to be for Out Loud, I approached the news director and the program director here and said it would be really great if we had a show at least once a month that's specifically for the trans community. And so I wrote a proposal and dropped it off at KBOO, and about 3 months later, they gave us this block. But Monica had a catch. She said, why don't we make it a collective? Because there's a lot of people who want to do trans programming down here at KBOO. And I was like, yes, that's a collective. Sounds great. So for anyone who's listening, this is your show too. It's really important that you see that this is KBOO belongs to everyone in the community. And this is really your show. And this is actually a great time to do the messaging that we're supposed to do. We're supposed to talk at least once a show about the opportunities down here at KBOO, so why don't we just squeeze it in right here. At KBOO, we have a dynamic community of 500 volunteers who keep our station running. Depending on your interest and availability, there are a great variety of things that you can do. KBOO offers training in radio production, voice and microphone skills, audio editing, field recording for volunteers. Do you want to get involved? Contact Ani, the volunteer coordinator. Her email address is volunteer@kboo.org, or you can call 503-231-8032, extension 213, if you'd like to get involved. So that is our promo that we're supposed to read this show. So thank you so much, all of you, for coming. And why don't we take a little break? We're going to take just a little break here for a minute, break one. And we're going to go into a conversation after break one about some of our hopes and expectations about the program. So let's go to break one now. Great. We are back on. And so we're going to have a little conversation now about some of our hopes and expectations for the show and, you know, some of our experiences of identity, you know, and what that means to us. So how should we get this conversation going? Let's just start with what are your dreams for the show? What would you like the show to be like in the future? Anyone?
Well, this is Rowan. I would be really excited to talk about history, unsurprisingly, but also current events. There sure are lots of things happening to and with and by and for trans people nowadays. So there's lots of grist for the mill there.
Okay. Also, like a couple of things that I've been getting from the community that I think are really important. One is people would like to talk about trans businesses. So people who own businesses and who promote businesses within the community that are specifically catered towards the trans community or trans owned. And I've also heard from people who would like us to talk about the music scene in Portland and people who are doing trans music or, you know, trans performers. So I think that that's also like the arts and culture aspect is really important. It sounds like we also have maybe like transition stories that people would like to talk about.
Kyle here. I mean, I think it would be a lot of fun for me and maybe the audience, since I'm going to be starting my transition here very soon, to talk on those experiences and what they're like in the present. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how they affect me, how they affect work, my partner, everything involved with that. And it'd be a nice experience.
Mm-hmm. And then it sounds like it's also really important for us to go over the experiences of the gender nonconforming community, binary, two-spirit, that whole area.
Yeah, definitely. This is Nico. Like I was talking about earlier, I'm finding that until recently, there was very little information on the non-binary and gender non-conforming community in general. You know, we still have people coming to terms with the fact that transgender people exist, period. And then on top of that, accepting the fact that there are more genders than just male and female, a lot of people are having a hard time wrapping their heads around that. And so I would like to bring more awareness to that community to help people understand what other kinds of genders there are besides male and female. Like, you know, me, I'm an androgen. I'm part male, part female. I tell people that and they're like, well, what does that mean? Are you a hermaphrodite? And, you know, they just can't quite grasp the concept. And so I'm hoping to help people understand what gender means and how it works.
Mm-hmm. And then hopefully we can educate the community too about some of the guidepost institutions within our community. For instance, we have two representatives here. Are you both on the Trans Justice Working Project with Basic Rights Oregon?
It seems like we are.
Yeah, uh-huh. I'm on the volunteer end of that, but mm-hmm. yeah.
I'm also on the volunteer end, okay, great. To be clear.
Yeah.
Let's explore that for just a minute, because I think that a lot of people maybe who aren't trans, I think that most of our trans community knows, but maybe people who aren't don't know what the trans working group is down at Basic Rights Oregon. Can you talk about that?
Go ahead and start.
BRO has had a structure for a while now where they have working groups that sort of govern their three different policy areas. Which used to be marriage, racial justice, and trans justice, and are now racial justice, trans justice, and emerging things. But one, it's kind of the way that they've kept themselves honest as an organization by having a group of volunteer community members who come in and say, this is what we want the organization to do. These are the talking points we want you to use. These are the things we want you to pursue in terms of policy. And then, you know, historically we've been involved in making those things happen too, you know, showing up to court, showing up to City Hall, writing memos. Like, it sort of vacillates that the level of depth the working group gets into year by year, but it's a cool way, and it's always open to new people for trans people to come and get involved with the work and really steer the direction of the organization in a pretty real way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I got involved. I went about a month ago to a discussion in a something that Bro hosted out in Dallas, Oregon, and they were down there to educate the community about the trans dialogue and introduce them to, you know, what the transgender community is, based on some of the issues that the community was having. But from there, I was able to meet people from Bro. And then was instantly asked to be part of this task force. So I'm in my second week of the task force, but I'm really excited about it. From what I could gather from a lot of the group is reaching out to all over Oregon and being available from, I think one of our volunteers is from rural Eastern Oregon, like out towards Lapine. And, you know, we have people on the coast and I'm in Salem. And so just having that outreach and being available to talk to different communities and being there for panels and narratives and just to educate everyone. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that whole issue of bringing in the trans community that's in rural Oregon is really important, because a lot of people do go through transition outside of Portland, and it might feel isolated.
Absolutely.
To go through that process. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and there are fantastic people doing work in all parts of the state. The person, I wish I remember his name, but there's the person that you were referencing out in Eastern Oregon has been doing amazing work getting people on Medicaid access to transitional care out in Eastern Oregon, and really doing like the granular, like finding the doctors, convincing them to provide the care.
Is that Shane Smith?
Yeah, totally. Yes, it's Shane.
Shane. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like part of the goal of the working group is also to get people like that some resources institutionally and be like, okay, well, would it help if we, you know, if you could call Bro and be like, hey, I need a lawyer to send this person a message, or, you know, whatever, things like that. It's not just a matter of helping Bro do their work, but Bro helping other people do their work.
Mm-hmm. And also educating those in the health field in rural Oregon who may have never had a trans patient.
Yeah.
And how to, you know, accept them.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I remember some statistics I read recently about transgender patients in healthcare. I read that, you know, about 50% of trans patients actually have to educate their providers about how to adequately treat them. And, you know, even worse than that, you know, we've got, I think it was 28% of trans people report experiencing harassment when accessing healthcare, 19% report being denied healthcare due to their gender identity. It's pretty scary stuff. And so I think, especially in the healthcare community, is where we need to start spreading some of that education.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd also hopefully like us to get into issues of homelessness within the trans community, because I know that homelessness, and especially homeless youth, is a really big issue within our community. People who end up out on the streets because their parents have kicked them out, or they don't have the financial means to support themselves. I'd like to bring in, there's a couple of groups in Portland that specialize in trying to help find housing for queer and trans people who are looking for housing. And I know that that's a big issue. Also talking about jobs, employment discrimination, what are your rights as a trans person? What are some issues that you face? Maybe you face discrimination within the workplace, and what can you do if you need to combat that? I hope that over the course of the next, you know, however long our show goes, that we talk about trans people of color. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah.
And that we talk about, you know, let trans people of color especially speak for themselves. I really don't want to speak at all for trans people of color, but I really want to make sure that we make that a priority of the show, because I know that that's really important. And Maria, you want to talk about, like, partners of trans people?
Yeah. I think that's an important part, too, because oftentimes, you know, the statistics are not good for a trans person and their partner to stay together. But I think as long as there's good communication, I think it's often less scary than it seems. And I think there's great potential for the love to just deepen and the connection to grow stronger through the transition. Basically, you are transitioning along with your partner, and it's important to acknowledge that growth within yourself as well as your partner. And unfortunately, a lot of people just are afraid. They get scared, and I understand that. But it's also important to understand that that creates change. You know, fear and being afraid, that's just us getting out of our comfort zone. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, I had dinner this weekend with my partner, who I've been married to for a while, and we went and had dinner with three trans friends, all who are divorced, and the reason that they're divorced is because they transitioned, and their partners left them when they transitioned, and that's a reality that lots and lots of trans people face. Is that issue of, you know, being separated from your partner specifically because of transition. And that's a huge issue because it impacts the partner who transitions on a really deep emotional level, because they're, you know, they count on their partner if they're married for a lot of support. And if they lose that, that's one of the reasons that the trans community has such a high rate of suicide. I mean, that's only one of many reasons, right. But our community, I think, has like 41% attempted suicide, which is just a huge statistic. So hopefully we'll get into some of those issues too. What else do people want to talk about over the next year, 2 years, however long we have the show?
12 years.
12 years, yes. 20.
I would love to be able to convince some other like trans activist type characters to come on the show and talk about their work. Mm-hmm. You know, some of my personal heroes like Julie Serrano, Susan Stryker, you know, there are lots of names.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It'd be great to, I mean, there's so much happening right now nationally with the trans community. It's just amazing. There's one person that I don't want to have on the show. And I won't even mention her name.
Okay.
But she's the most prominent one right now, and I don't really want her on the show.
Oh, yeah. Well. It's funny how we all know.
I mean,
exactly.
Everyone needs a trans ambassador, and Republican Mormons need Republican Scientologists need a trans person to explain transness to them too. So, you know, I guess Godspeed in that.
Yeah.
But it might be important also to just bring up some of the struggles that other states are having. I mean, we're all really lucky in Oregon. I mean, lucky as we can be, I guess, at this point. But just knowing how far behind other states are, and, you know, mm-hmm. Oregon setting a good example and moving towards the right path. So
right, mm-hmm. And also know that legislation that would have been really dastardly for trans people was proposed in Oregon as well. It's just that it was quickly suppressed here because we have many allies in the legislature in this state, and a lot of states are not lucky enough to have that be the case. So it's not that we necessarily have like a you know, none of those people in our state. It's just that we have a certain amount of power here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're incredibly lucky. I feel like Portland is kind of a trans mecca in a way. I mean, from what I hear from all the people who are moving here, and part of it, I know people are moving here now specifically because we have really good access to healthcare.
Right.
And that's really important. We're going to be getting into that in about 10 minutes. But, you know, I know a lot of people are moving to Oregon specifically because this is an issue that we as trans people face. You know, the issue of having access to healthcare is really, really important, and it's an important part of transition. So, But it's not just that. There's something about Portland that, like, seems to draw, like, trans, queer, gender, non-binary, two-spirit, intersex people. Like, you know, there's something about the community that I think is welcoming and really kind of engaging. I mean, how many of you were at the trans march last year?
I was at it.
Mm-hmm. What did you think?
It was very cool to see such a huge gathering of people supporting this cause, and everyone was just coming together and acting like a family, a community, and we were all fighting for the same thing. It was very uplifting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was kind of my impression too. I'm hoping that the trans march is just like such an important part of our community. And they just had the Transgender Day of Visibility, The same people who are doing the trans march, which is Greater Portland Trans Unity. And they just had this event last week downtown. And so I'm hoping that some of those people will come on our show and talk about the trans march for this year, which I think is June 11th.
Yeah. Yes, it's like or sometime around Pride, like right before Pride.
Right.
Yeah. I'm hoping to be there again this year.
Yeah, totally. And there's also like, I have a lot of heroes just locally.
Yeah.
I mean, people who are just like so fundamental to our community, who I think have just done so much. I mean, a lot of them are down at Bro. You know, Joe, I'd love to have Joe on sometime talking about all the work that he's done. Ethan from the Q Center, I'd love to have Ethan on. Ethan is like such an important, I mean, he's one of my personal heroes that I just admire so much in the community. I'd like to have Jackie on from NWGA. You know, there's so many people who like, just to me are like locally heroes who have really, they've been out in the trenches, they've been doing the hard work, you know, and it's like, they've been the people who have really been helping to make our community so strong and what it is now. You know, we have this really vibrant community here. We have trans artists, we have writers, we have performers. You know, there's the Trans Open Mic, which also Greater Portland Trans Unity does, which really focuses on trans people of color and all of their stories. So there's like so much that we can do. And I think it's really exciting.
Totally. I want to, while we're on the subject, plug my friend Mickey and I are going to be starting a trans movie watching and discussion group. Cool. Every month at the Q Center. And our first movie that we're going to watch and discuss is going to be Tangerine. And so that's going to be happening the third Saturday of May is going to be the first one. And then it's going to be the third Saturday of every month, I believe. And so, you know, because it's not that often that, I mean, Tangerine is fantastic, but most trans movies are not super great. I think it's fair to say, like, and often the trans people are not played by trans actors. And so it's, I think having a forum where we can actually discuss those films afterwards is especially important. I know that I don't really want to watch them by myself most of the time, especially if it's one of the trope genre of the trans person dies at the end, which I generally don't watch, but I would with other people. So, yeah, it's going to be the third Saturday of every month at the Q Center starting in May.
Oh, cool. Yeah, and there's so much stuff at the Q Center. I think we could do a whole show just about like the trans groups at the Q Center.
Yeah.
There's trans guys. There's there's the Friday Night Support Group. There's Trans Femme. There's what's the group that meets on Mondays there? There's so many. There's also a group for partners of transitioning people. So, you know, it's just the Q Center, a shout out to the Q Center. It's just such a great resource for our community. And there's actually somebody right now trying to start another organization called the T Center, which is going to be just for the trans community. And he's She's been working on that for quite a while. So
cool.
Why don't we take a little break? And then when we come back, we're going to go over to Rowan and we're going to talk about the WPATH standards of care for the trans community.
I felt all flushed with fever, embarrassed by the crowd. I felt he found my letters and read each one out loud. I prayed that he would finish, but he just kept right on.
All right, we're back. And we are going to talk now with Rowan Everard. Rowan started a healthcare blog, right? Was it a, or no, you were working on a podcast.
Oh, yeah. So I was and maybe still am going to do that. And mm-hmm. I was about to record my first episode actually when I heard that this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to do this instead for the moment, but I might do that too.
Great. Well, lucky us.
So one of the issues that is really important to the trans community is dealing with issues of access to healthcare and even just what does it mean to transition. So tonight we thought we would talk with Rowan about the WPATH standards of care for the trans community. So Rowan, first of all, can you tell us what are the WPATH standards of care?
Yeah, the WPATH standards of care. So WPATH is the World Professional Association for the Treatment Trans healthcare. There we go. It formerly the Harry Benjamin Society for the Treatment of Transsexual People. And I'll talk about Harry Benjamin in a minute. But the standards of care are a sort of quasi legal document that, that, you know, establishes, somewhat uniform approaches to treating trans people. It covers transitional care. It also covers, some elements of just psychological care for people, whether or not they're going through medical transition. And they've been through many revisions. We're now on our 7th edition. And they started out super gatekeepery, and they've gotten less so over the years based on, you know, pretty broad criticism from inside the trans community as well as our allies. And they kind of, well, yeah, I can talk about it a little bit more later, but that's the gist.
Mm-hmm. So the WPATH standards of care are there to specifically help, help who? Are they there to help trans people? Are they there for the medical community? Who are they there for in
yeah,
the first place?
They're kind of there for all of those groups of people. And they're complicated for that reason because they exist. I like to think about things in terms of good faith and bad faith. And so the good faith argument for the standards of care is pretty straightforward in that, like, when they were created in the 70s, there was this group of psychologists and other sort of endocrinologists and other associated care providers who were like, you know, all these trans people are coming to us asking for this care, and we don't have any sort of standardized thing that we're giving people. And that is a problem not only because people don't know what they're doing, but also because it creates a lot of room for creepy people to experiment on trans people. Mm-hmm. And there's a long medical history of that. You know, the woman who is featured in, what is that new movie? The Danish Girl. Like, the reason why she died was because the second surgery that she went through was an experimental surgery. That when you have this sort of circumstance where you're saying, okay, we'll give you this medical thing that you need, but only if you allow to do this extra procedure that we haven't been working on. If that's your only option, then you're going to say yes. And that really opens up a lot of opportunities for shenanigans that really hurt or possibly kill trans people. And so there's this group of people saying, like, we need to safeguard against that. We need to create some sort of uniformity. So that's the you know, the good faith argument. The bad faith argument is that you have some people in that group who basically think that all trans people should be treated as children. And that trans people, you know, have this mental disorder that makes us think that we're really one thing, even though we're not. And therefore that we need to establish all of these rules to make sure that people who are, I don't know, and it's hard to describe this fear because it doesn't make any sense to me, but the best way that I can think of it is it's kind of this equivalent of drug seeking, that there are all these trans people out there that this group of people thinks are trying to get surgery even though they don't really need it, because they're actually this other thing rather than trans, and it's kind of a morass of problems.
It really is an issue. Like I know someone within the community who has a mental health diagnosis and is trans identified.
Right.
And I was actually talking with someone, I think it was Zay from Basic Rights Oregon, the other day down at the Transgender Day of Visibility. And I was asking them specifically about this issue, because it's like, when does mental health diagnosis trump gender identity? Because apparently there are some situations in which it does.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where that line is, but I mean, you know, as a trans person, I forgot to say, I'm a trans guy. That's my thing. I am pretty reticent to say that because people have a dual diagnosis, they shouldn't be able to access transition. And that, I think, is kind of a red herring argument that gets made a lot within the psychological community, where people are saying, well, you know, this person is, like, for example, you know, what's the word? Floridly schizophrenic. And so as a result, we can't really be sure what they really want, because, like, one moment they think they're a snake and the next moment, whatever, right? And I think that, like, that does happen, but I don't think it's super common. And I think that most of the time it's like people are, you know, they're experiencing some, basically just some trauma sequelae, right? Because trans people experience a lot of violence, and as a result, we have mental health stuff. And so then you're like double victimizing people by saying, like, oh, well, the fact that you have PTSD or, you know, dissociative identity disorder or whatever as a result of these things that happened to you means that you can't access the medical care that you need because we don't like you. And it feels like it's just like, yeah, we have another excuse to deny you care because we can. Mm-hmm. But what I'm referring to specifically in this case is that there is a there's two diagnoses, actually. Now the DSM came out with one for trans men too, called autogynephilia and automasculophilia now, which is the, because they were like, oh, we have to, you know, even the scales, instead of removing the diagnosis, we'll just create one for everyone. It's where it's this diagnosis where you are sexually aroused by presenting in your felt gender, which, like, it doesn't make any sense, because, of course, if you are presenting in your felt gender, you're going to feel more comfortable engaging in sexuality. So that's a thing. But historically, it's been this way in which particularly trans women were denied access to care by instead being diagnosed with that. And that was its own, what they call a paraphilia in psychological parlance, which means that instead of being trans, you just have this mental problem where you're aroused by dressing in women's clothes and therefore you can't access transition. And so there's this whole list of things that trans people today still, but especially in prior eras, would have to be sure to do in order to be able to access transition. They wanted people to present in stereotypical gender presentation. They wanted people to be heterosexual. They wanted people to whatever. And if you didn't do any of those things, then you could not pass go to accessing transitional care. And so I was reading just today, Julia Serrano's book, Whipping Girl, the statistic that, like, of the 2,000 applications that one of the first gender clinics in San Francisco received from people, they only approved like 20 of them, because all of these other people were disqualified for various reasons, mostly among those. And then mental health diagnoses of any other kind is also in there. So horrifying.
Yeah. Has anyone here encountered any sort of barriers to access in terms of care because of, you know, WPATH standards of care questions with your healthcare providers, or have you had pretty clear and accessible access to care?
Is that a good question?
I've had difficulty accessing for my care. Being as an intersex person, I've been told by the doc that I'm not male, therefore I can't have certain hormones because they be because of my gender or whatnot. I'm not sure, because if you are a trans man, I assume you can get testosterone. But as a XY female, which is that is what I am technically, I can't access healthcare quite as easily, it seems like, sometimes. So there is sometimes the policy itself is a problem, whether or not it's trans or intersex or whatever kind of care for your endocrinological needs, you have difficulty when you're out of the norm. And you're out of the loop sometimes without being part of the discussion with scientists and other scientists, doctors, people that work in pharmacy. And that became an issue for me recently, even trying to access estradiol Valerate. It's just available in Washington, across the river up north. And that becomes another risk of being able to access it. It's just a kind of medication that's harder to get now because of increased regulation. And beyond that, the actual provider has to recommend it as a prescription. And that became hard for me, being that I'm female and asking for testosterone, asking for estradiol Valerate, and asking to inject it into my body versus the more traditional, probably not long, it probably hasn't been around for as long in comparison with the ointments they use now, but the more traditional pill form and sublingual. I've chosen a way that's very hard to get, and that's my problem right now.
Yeah, in my case, I mean, right now, there's not really any sort of surgery or hormone therapy for what I would want, given that I'm a non-binary person. I would have to be like a trans man to get any sort of transition help. And like, I've even tried asking a doctor if there might be some way to transition me to the way I feel my body should be. And she just kind of looked at me like I was crazy, literally, and just said, well, why would you even want that? Why do you think that kind of thing would exist, you know? So, you know, I realize it's probably going to be a long time before we start to have other sorts of transition aids for other types of transgender people. But I think that, you know, we need to start getting the ball rolling now and helping people realize that there are other types of trans people that still need help.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we take our last break? And then we'll do our break number 3. And then after that, we'll go into a little bit of a conversation about the WPATH standards of care with respect to gender non-binary people and kind of maybe play out the discussion a little bit more for the end of the show. So can we go to break 3? Maybe. Maybe not. Okay. That's fine. Why don't we just keep on going? Let's just keep on going then.
Keep rolling.
So the WPATH standards of care, do they address gender non-binary people?
Not necessarily. Not explicitly. Not really. The standards of care, so I should back up and say that the standards of care, they're not a legal document in the sense that they're not binding. Like, no doctor has to do what the standards of care suggest. They're guidelines, they're suggestions. But a lot of doctors treat them as though they're law. And so a lot of doctors will not deviate from what it says in the standards of care, specifically around dosages of hormones and amounts of time people have to be taking hormones before they can access surgery and whatever. Like, those are all recommendations, but because WPATH is the only people sort of weighing in on it at a national and an international level, doctors feel really freaked out, and so they don't want to. Doctors don't like to do things that there isn't precedent for, because then it opens them up to malpractice lawsuits. So it's a double bind, especially for non-binary people, because it's like, if you're asking doctors to do something new and it's not explicitly laid out in the standards of care, then they're super unlikely to be willing to do it.
That is exactly the reason I had difficulty with my preferences for hormonal care. They found it was unusual. I'm the first person in the Portland area that's actually gone to OHSU and requested this kind of care as a female in, you know, phenotype, and then my genotype is male. I had to, you know, experience a big no for a long time, go through different sources, like at the NCNM, I was able to be seen there and outside in. Unfortunately, though, I have to go back to OHSU, and I have found that they're willing to work with me, though they're uncomfortable filling actually writing out my prescription for it. So they require me to go to somewhere else because they're uncomfortable with the risk that would pose for me to inject myself with testosterone, cyanate, and estradiol valerate.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of this also, to give the doctors a little bit of credit, is just that there's no research on trans care, and very little research on trans care, especially like almost all of it comes out of the Netherlands. And so doctors don't like doing things that isn't research because they're just like, well, is this safe? We don't know. And that's not, that's the fault of the medical industry and the medical institutions at a more broad level, that they're not actually researching the safety of, or, you know, not even safety, but just like, what is best, what works best, and what doesn't work as well. And so as a result, the doctors are just like, eh, what do we do?
What provides the better quality of life?
Right, of course. Yeah.
What about, how do the standards of care address the intersex community?
There's very limited resources, as Rowan's mentioned, that we have very limited research being done. The only research I found recently that was really helpful was a study that was done in Germany for CAIS, women with complete androgenine insensitivity syndrome, which made them deal differently in their bodies with androgenine hormones. So for my experience was, when I was told about the test, that some had an increase in their quality of life from the hormone, I felt it was worth a try myself. I tried this hormone before that. It was before too long, and it was really helpful. I found I definitely decided that it was a need in that, in a nutshell, was one of the things I did to transition almost to a way. It was transitioning to my back to the normal, for my normal, natural hormone level. Yeah. And that's been kind of decided for me based on my experience. And I've gone up too high and too low, and I've had risks probably from that self-experimentation, I guess you could call it that.
Yeah. That's an important issue too, is just the issue of how do people have access to hormones, and, you know, what do we do to encourage people to go see a doctor to get proper dosages? Because I know a lot of people get their dosages online, or they get them from their friends. And I guess that's part of what the WPATH standards of care are there for. But I know that sometimes people feel like things just go too slow. Like, I mean, it's not necessarily true. Well, I don't know. I shouldn't make any assumptions. I don't know how it is for the transmasculine community. And so someone from the transmasculine community might want to speak for their own perspective on dosaging and hormones. But I know that for the trans female community, it depends a lot on what age you start at. You know, so if you start young, and this is also a whole show topic, which we should probably invite Jen Burlington down and people from Transactive to talk about trans youth. But if you start with androgen blockers when you're young, and sorry not to be excluding members of the intersex community, I'm just talking trans feminine right now. But if you start with dosage blockers when you're young, and then when you reach an age of consent and can begin on hormones, then the transition is very different from if you start the way that most typical trans women start, when they've already gone through male puberty, and then they transition. And so then the process is really kind of slow. But a lot of trans women feel like it's not fast enough, and so they'll dosage higher, or they'll do other things, like they might do silicone injections, you know, in order to get the desired changes, which then creates a whole nother set of health hazards, which can be really dangerous. I know lots of trans women who need to get silicone taken out of their bodies that they've injected.
There's a pretty high infection risk, especially if you're doing it kind of at home and not ideally sterile conditions. There's been a lot of historical disregard for the distress of trans people from the medical community, that like, oh, these trans people, like, they're always really anxious, and they want all these things, and they want them to be happening faster, and just a like really huge lack of empathy and appreciation for what it's like to be a trans person experiencing dysphoria. Even though they know the statistics about suicide attempts, I think that, you know, that's starting to change, but it's been really hard. And so a lot of doctors will start trans people in kind of like a trial dosage, like, well, you know, we'll give you a little bit, and then if you really like it, we'll give you a little bit more. And it's kind of like, it's creepy. And not all doctors do that. Some doctors are great, but But so that's one factor. And then, yeah, age can be, I mean, I like Jen Burlton's way that she talks about it around a lot of the surgeries that we see people getting actually being correcting for lack of access to care previously. So like, you know, if you've had to go through a puberty that wasn't your desired puberty, then you have to undo, you have to, in the case of if you're a trans man, then you have to get your breasts undone, basically, instead of just not having grown them in the first place, right? And so there are, to a certain extent, irreversible side effects from going through the wrong puberty. And the longer that goes on, the harder it can be for people who feel like they've gone through the wrong thing. And so it's important to be able to intervene soon. And it's just that trans people historically have had such little institutional power to advocate for ourselves as patients that we've had to rely on these doctors, you know, sort of benevolent parent figures. And some of them, like Carrie Benjamin, have been great. And others of them, like Ken Mooney, have been awful and terrifying and I think should be in jail. But they're not, because that's not up to us. Mm-hmm. Ken Mooney, by the way, does reparative therapy on trans kids. That's his, and he was involved in he was actually on the committee that updated the trans section of the DSM-5, because I guess you just can't get rid of these older white guys. They just hang around forever.
Do you want to say something?
Yes, I guess my own experience lended towards, I guess, commenting on what you've said. I've had, because of my upbringing and being decided what gender because of my condition, I can't really change from one gender, because I, out of the womb, became this because of my genetic condition. So even taking testosterone at higher doses than estrogen, I didn't change to male. But when I was young, I wasn't given the option to take male hormones. Mm. And because of the gonadectomy that, you know, occurred when I was almost three, I don't have the ability to produce my own sexual hormones. So understanding that condition, it was in the works for the docs to do at that point in time. The surgery happened during a gonadectomy happened because of another surgery. They noticed the testicular mass in my body instead of regular genitalia in the female. So now I have to actually take hormones because of the doctor's choices.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that legacy of non-consensual surgeries on intersex children is really horrifying.
So we're going to kind of do a wrap up now because we only have about 2 minutes left. Let's all go around one last time and just kind of say goodbye and say our names, and we'll see you next month. So I'm Emma Lugo.
I'm Natasha Delapine.
I'm Kyle Ward.
I'm
Maria Ward.
I'm Rowan Everard.
I'm Nicolette James.
Great. And you have been listening to Trans Positive PDX. We're so excited to be here. I really hope that you will consider joining our collective. You can find us online at transpositivepdx@gmail.com, or you can find us on the new and fabulous KBOO website, which is going to launch tomorrow. So yay. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Everybody have a good evening.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
One, two, three, drink. One, two, three, one, two, three, drink. Turn back to life.